Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
Welcome, Michael.
Hi, Jill. Nice to be here.
No, it's wonderful to have you finally. We've tried to do this for many, many years. We did one show some years back, and a lot has happened since then. You're actually visiting the East Coast here, teaching at, what is it, Westchester University?
Yeah, every summer I come out to Philadelphia, teach at Villanova University for a couple of weeks, and at Westchester as well, teaching music teachers.
Now, what are you teaching? Are you teaching guitar or are you teaching banjo?
Well, both. I teach music teachers how to use a guitar in the classroom, and so some of them are beginning players, some of them have some experience, but all of them, the classes go all day, 8 hours a day, from 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., and this week it's at Westchester. It's a kind of a beginning players class, and people who are, some of them will be teaching in the fall, so they're preparing to teach guitar for the first time. At Villanova earlier in the summer, there was a class called America Folk Instruments and History as well, and in that class, you had to play the guitar to get into the class, and then because you can fret that instrument and play some things on there, I also taught you in the course of 1 week how to play the banjo, the mandolin, the ukulele, and the harmonica.
That's kind of a crash course, isn't it? And you have on your stationery musician, composer, and musical playwright. And there's so much to talk about with you. First of all, was that an original work that you opened?
Yeah, yes, that was.
What is it?
That's called Guaracha.
I was going to say it felt like I wanted to dance.
Yeah, it's a Cuban rhythm, but a melody that's one of the movements of the Suite for the Americas. That has a number of other movements.
Now, let's start at the beginning, if we possibly can.
Right.
You started as a student of guitar many, many years ago. Is that what happened?
I started playing the guitar. I was self-taught. Self-taught.
Really?
I started playing the guitar when I was just a kid. You know, I had a little rock and roll band and stuff. And then when I was in, my schools didn't really have much in the way of music at all, and I didn't play seriously until I was about 21. And
any family members?
My father played the player piano. He was a blue collar guy. He'd come home from work and he would sit at his player piano and he would sing old show tunes, you know. And I'm one of my earlier recollections is I'm trying to go to sleep, and he's down in the basement with his buddies, and they're all standing around singing 76 trombones at the big parade, stuff like that. So there was music in the house,
okay.
You know, music in the house.
Well, he probably wanted to play, though.
Well, he played. I think he was perfectly happy doing all that, you know, doing what he did. He was a Mr. Fix-It guy, and he loved playing that player piano, you know.
So you actually decided you wanted to play the guitar. Is that it?
I had an older brother, was kind of a folky, he had like a Kingston Trio sort of group. So, of course, some older brother role model, you know.
That was kind of sexy, you know.
So I picked that up and, you know, I learned to just started. He had some songs, you know, just words and chords, and I kind of started poking around
and you just
playing that.
Learned.
Well, I just taught myself a few things, and then when I was 21, I went to England. I studied in England, and there was the first time I had a teacher in England at the University of Lancaster, and I studied with this guy for about a year, and he was a terrific, encouraging teacher, you know, who liked all the things that I liked my ideas and didn't sort of force me into a box, and was there that year in England that I went on tour with a street theater, and it was on the street theater in France that I heard the first time I heard
the banjo
played the way that I played in this style called frailing and claw hammer.
Okay, now again, you started in guitar. That was
the
first
thing. Yeah, I
started
on guitar. Yeah.
And when did you start with the banjo?
I was 21.
So that actually, up to that time, up to the time you went to abroad, and you were studying guitar with this teacher in England.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and then you started freelancing or
then
whatever.
I started,
you were a street player. Okay.
Yeah. Well, there was one summer that was in this street theater, and then I went back. I came, it was 1 year in England, and I came back to America, and then I started. I taught myself to play the banjo. I studied the guitar a little bit further at that point, and then. I graduated with a degree in oral interpretation,
which is
a mix of theater and literary criticism.
Did you ever think you would be interested in theater? Are you a balladeer? I mean, is this the whole culture of this kind of an instrument somehow?
Well, yeah. After music, politics is my passion, and so the works, the musical playwright piece of my career is mixing music, politics, and history. And so my one-man show, for example, which for a long time was called The Magic Banjo, and now it's called From Senegal to Seeger, Stories of the American Banjo, traces the early roots of the banjo, its African origins, and then some of its life here in America. And this work is also literary. It includes the works of Walt Whitman and Carl Sandburg, Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, and it's political in that it also features Pete's testimony before the House Un-American Activities Committee.
He was very instrumental, if you'll forgive the pun, in your life, and approved of what you did.
He was a big supporter of mine, and I had just incredible serendipity. Somewhere down the line, after I was finished with college and now out as a working musician for a while and tending bar and doing things that people do to survive, I started working at a place in Chicago called the Old Town School of Folk Music. I started teaching there, teaching banjo and guitar. And then a position opened up for a program director. So I applied and I got that job. And I started making lots of changes. The school had 200 students at the time, and I started making a number of changes to things because I just felt like it was a grand place waiting for more success and open
probably to new ideas.
Right. And that was why they brought me in, to bring in new ideas. And
did you know that you wanted to do this? I mean, this whole path, life is very funny. It leads you on paths that you never even thought you'd explore.
No, I never envisioned myself running a music school or into fast forward into the future teaching music teachers either.
How to teach in a music school.
Yes, right. Yes. But I had my, brief experience in a music school and decided that was not the way to learn. I didn't like that particularly.
Was it too structured?
It was a little too ego-driven and too competitive and not supportive enough, and I thought that there's ways of, music is this expression of the heart, and with technique required, there's ways to get it and there's people I want to be around. I decided, I will find the people who can teach me what it is that I want to learn outside of the structured system. And anyway, into the Old Town School, I beat the streets of Chicago and found the best musicians in town and brought them in. And in short order, the school went, when I started, we had 200 students, and when I left 15 years later, we had 5,000.
Oh my goodness.
Who were
goodness.
Coming through each week. And
isn't
the city
that
had,
amazing?
The city had given us this grand building, 40,000 square feet, and I had a picture of Mayor Daley holding my banjo. And,
isn't that fantastic?
And along the way, Pete Seeger, because Pete, he sent me a note after I'd been working there for a little while, and he said, because he was on the mailing
Mike,
list.
Mike, I have to call.
All right.
Sorry. Sorry. Okay. Go back about good. Pete Seeger.
So Pete was on the mailing list and of the school, folk school, and so one day out of the blue, I got a letter from him, and it said, "Dear Mike, looks like you're doing good things. Keep up the good work, your friend Pete." Oh my God. Here's a, you know, just another.
And a legend, actually.
Yes, yeah. A living legend sending me a piece. So I wrote him back and I said, "Dear Pete, I can't believe you wrote me a letter. You know, you certainly made my day. And here's this book that I had written at that point on how to play the banjo. And here's was the first recording that I had done was called Counterpoint. It was half done on a cassette tape. I said, and here's this will be my first CD when it's done, but here it is in work in progress. And I sent it to him. And then 2 weeks later, I got another letter from him. This one was 2 pages long, typed, single-space typed letter. And in this, he said, Of all the recordings I've ever heard in all my 70 years, this is one of the most beautiful. It's enough to make me want to learn the banjo all over again. And in the wintertime, I'll be ice skating in my backyard because I freeze it and ice skate with my grandchildren and we'll be out there listening to your music.
What a wonderful thing to say.
You know, it was an amazing thing to say. And so that was 25 years ago, and we've written letters back and forth.
The banjo itself, it's a whole other experience musically. I mean, it is not an orchestral instrument in a sense. It's kind of it's a folk instrument. It's a pop instrument. Mm. I guess it's jazz as well, but it's really more down home. I mean, it's not in the concert hall the way we think of that.
Yeah. Well, right, because it has its
it has its
reputation, which is a little tawdry, you know, and associated with, you know, most people's exposure to the banjo is the Beverly Hillbillies or Deliverance or, you know.
Which was brilliant playing, I might say.
Sure. But most of the people who are drawn to the banjo are drawn in through traditional music, bluegrass, folk songs, and whatnot, and there they stay, and that's, you know,
where's the banjo from initially?
Africa. I mean, the idea and this I get at in my one man show, that the earliest documentation of the banjo in North America is on slave ships, written in journals where people describe seeing them. And the sad truth is that slave traders found that having musicians and musical instruments lowered the mortality rate on the slave ships. And so they made efforts to make sure that they were bringing them and became the inadvertent importers of African music. Now the banjo as it first arrived didn't look like this one at all. It would be the instruments the bodies would be either hollowed out logs or gourds, calabash, a drum head, a string, somehow of anything, you know.
A stalk of
could
some
be
kind.
I have an instrument from Senegal that the neck is the equivalent of like a broomstick.
I was going to say
perfectly round. The strings are made of fishing line, and basically it's a drum with strings. And from the idea of that a musical instrument could be one of the first musical instruments on the planet was a drum. One of the first string instruments on the planet would have been a banjo-like thing, because you attach strings to a drum and you have a banjo, the beginnings of a banjo.
Well, a lot of, I think, foreign instruments look like that. I mean, there are...
Well, right, and so the technology of drum with strings grew up in a number of places. I mean, the ones that how it came to America was from West Africa, but there is the Tibetan lute,
yes,
drum-based string instrument. There's the sarod in India, which is similar to the sitar, except it has a drum head. So it too is a drum-based string instrument.
You know, I never thought of that as a drum. One never thinks of it because you kind of think of it as other stringed instruments, of course, for resonance, but you don't think of it as for percussion, you know what I mean.
Well, no, it's not. I mean, it's not played as a drum,
but it has a resonance. But there is a quality to the banjo. I mean, it's a unique sound. Mm-hmm. You did something fantastic. We talked about, and you had recorded. You played Bach on the banjo. Why?
Well, I was enchanted with Bach, and I love classical music, and I don't draw these lines of distinction that many people do between folk and jazz and classical and pop music and whatnot. I kind of heap it all together as rhythm and melody, and I listened to a lot of classical music and particularly Baroque and Renaissance mm-hmm. stuff, and that music is the particular Renaissance music very folk like.
They did mandolin. I mean, Vivaldi had some mandolin.
Yeah, of course.
Playing,
and Bach's lines are they're so tuneful, and I tried. They were transcribed. The cello suites were transcribed for guitar. I played a little bit on the guitar, and then I thought, well, I could try this on the banjo. I started with the gigue of the third suite, mm-hmm. and then made my way through the third suite. And it took me a long time to, I was going from the cello score to writing out banjo tablature, and then ultimately, trying to create the fingering and seeing how this could work, and it became like drug addiction or something. I have another angle on what this instrument can sound like, and the when I play the banjo, I like to explore other. I like to explore Bach. I like to explore my own melodies. I like to look at music that you don't necessarily hear the banjo. And a frequent comment when I'll play is people say, "Wow, well, I never knew that the banjo could sound like
sure.
that." And that's not an uncommon remark because, well, that would be sort of expected because most of the time when you hear the banjo, it's in a box. It's in the bluegrass box.
Now, but you do much more than this. I mean, you, as you said, you're into politics. You're into what mm. they do, they, in quotes, do mm. with folk instruments. It's you're going far beyond just the performance on the instrument mm-hmm. and exploring the possibilities of the instrument. You're adding a great deal to it as a personality, as a historian, as a political, I guess, viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you classify yourself now?
Well, that's a tricky one. I see. Tell me about your life in 30 seconds or less. Well, I have all these different dimensions, and one of them on that subtitle there, musician, composer, musical playwright, and I suppose educator too. My world is about half education and half performance, and so I spend a lot of time working with kids and working with music teachers, and I spend a lot of time on the stage in performance on my own, in performance with larger ensembles that I create, in performance with string quartets and orchestras,
Is it strictly musical performance, or are you telling stories? Are you?
I have a couple of different shows that I do. One of them is called America 1968. That's a musical political profile of that year. I did one called America 1941. That was that year. There is the American Songbag, which is a portrait of the 20th century, decade by decade.
That's an important
as music. It's based on Carl Sandburg's premise, which is in his book, The American Songbag. Published in 1927, which was a collection of songs. And in that, he said, the songs tell our story in a way that you don't get in history books. So that songs, like the songs of the 1930s, portray that decade in a way that's different from
yes.
what you'd read about. Or the songs of the Vietnam War era, or the songs of the 1950s. And they all have a certain emotional atmosphere that you know, when you hear them, they take you there. And so that interests me. And I like to – and I use both the guitar and the banjo to do those.
That must be a transforming experience each time you do it, I would think. You really put yourself in another place and you bring it to whoever's listening. That must be a thrilling thing to do, or satisfying, and certainly in any way.
Well, it is, and among the because literature, it's these things are all literary, and the the Magic Banjo, for example, included the works of Whitman and Sandburg. And to say their words, it's similar to performing Bach's melodies.
Well, it's the poetry of greatness.
Right.
Yes,
it's so rich. It's so rich and it's so it's powerful. And when you and poetry live is similar in that to Bach, in that sometimes you say a line that you've said numerous times, 50 times, on the 51st mm-hmm. time. Some word comes out a little different. Camarado, I give you my hand. I give you my love more precious than money. I give you myself before preaching or law. Will you give me yourself? Will you come travel with me? Shall we stick with each other as long as we live? That's Whitman, the end of Song of the Open Road. Those 40 words or whatever they are, you know, I've said that I get chills when I say them and what word's going to jump out differently because it's so dense. There's no, it's like Bach, you know, Bach doesn't let you breathe sometimes, you know, it's just da da da. It's all this stuff there.
Yeah.
And Whitman, some of his stuff is that way as well. I can't believe I, you know, get to do these things. My undergraduate degree ended up being an oral interpretation, that mix of a literary criticism and theater. I didn't know that it'd be possible to create have a living doing this. But mm-hmm. in fact, I've met with enough agreement through my music and through my the works, the plays that I've written, that in fact, this is what I do. And you know,
how many shows have you done? I mean, in terms of new works.
New works, oh, probably 10 or 12. Mm-hmm. And I don't, they're not all current, but I have them, you know, they're up on my website, and I have an agent who helps to promote them and sell them across the country. The biggest one is the banjo one, the Senegal to Seagull.
Now, you told me something before. You had done something. You went to Morocco, isn't that recent? Was that recent?
Well,
not so recent anymore.
It was. We flew to Morocco the day the Senate voted to go to war with Iraq. So that was in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
The show I'd written for that was called Chicago Rhythm and Rhymes. It was a piece about the music from Chicago. I had a quartet. And the poetry from Chicago, and some included some original poetry of mine that was in this, and and there was a quartet, a singer Jackie Allen, a drummer, and upright bass, and we went all across Morocco. We were there for a couple of weeks. We played in grand places like the Marrakesh Opera House, beautiful place, mm-hmm. and then in some little towns like in the equivalent of the high school gym, you know, in little places for communities. And everywhere we went, I said I would like if the people who were taking us around, there was the U.S. State Department was in participation with the city of Chicago and this theater in Chicago called Pegasus Players Theater. They were all the producing it, and so. They took us. I said, "Can you please arrange for local musicians everywhere we go? I'd like to collaborate with local bands, and whomever you can find would be fine with me because I have drums and bass, and if whatever happens, we can make it work and bring it to an end if need be." And so I went from playing with this guy Haj Younes, and Haj is like one of the prides of Morocco. It's an amazing oud player, to just playing with some of the local bands in these other towns, and the amazing thing and was about this gift of musicians. Mm. The rest of the world has to talk to one another in order to create a relationship. Musicians, all you have to do is play. If you play for me and I like the sound of it, I like you personally,
right, exactly.
And vice versa. And so this started to happen all across the country. You know, we were making friends, and I learned to speak a little Arabic, Berlitz phrases, but enough that it was a gesture. I'd walk out on stage, and the first things that I would say would be in Arabic versus in English. And people seem to, you know, it's
appreciate
a gesture.
That,
it's a gesture.
Of course,
it's a, you know, and I.
And effort.
And at one place, and this was one of the most amazing events of the entire tour, was one place we went. The local imam came, and the imam is the priest of the local mosque, and he came to see what was going on. And this was one of the smaller communities, and he didn't know what was going on, and he went up to the guy who was taking us around. His name was Abdel Krim, and says, "So Abdel Krim, who are these people up on this stage?" Abdel Krim says, "Well, these are Americans." And the imam says, "These cannot be Americans. These are not Americans." Abdel Krim says, "These are Americans." No. They're not Americans. These are Americans. I brought them here. The imam says, "Well, if these are Americans, send more of them."
Well, what did he think an American was supposed to be like?
Well, I don't know. But at that point, because it was the war had
of
just was looming, and the public attitude in Morocco was declining towards America, but yet he was seeing the benefit of this musical collaboration with the community that was happening here on their stage with people who would attend his mosque and the place was alive with music and mutual respect and appreciation and
What have you done with that experience? Anything?
Well, I certainly learned a lot from it. A lot of the stuff that we played was that recording, New Century Suite. The New Century Suite was one of the pieces that we played all across Morocco, and that featured, and we recorded that when we came back. That featured Jackie Allen singing a vocalese improvisation against the banjo lines. And what was nice about that and how well it worked in Morocco was, it was minor key, so it sort of fit with the kind of where their ears were at with what was popular, as well as no language barrier, because it was wordless, but it was very personal because of the singing. And so and when you hear it, you'll see it's like there's this passion about it that we kind of fine-tuned in Morocco and then came back to Chicago and recorded.
So your work is really a combination, as we said earlier, of music, of narrative, of poetry, documentary style, and of course it's presented on the stage.
Yeah, and that's perfectly you understand it perfectly, because I've tried to say, well, what are these, and I have called them musical documentaries for the stage.
Yes,
exactly that.
And that's a rare commodity. You get a good turnout with that.
Yeah. We've had it varies from place to place because it's non-commercial. It's not commercial stuff, and so I need I find presenters who are interested in it or who are willing to take a risk with it, and theaters, theaters that will present it, and my agent looks around and tries to find art centers that do it, and in the meantime I'll do other, also like later in November I'm doing a concert with the Butler County Symphony here in Pennsylvania, on the western side of the state, where we're doing some of my works, my compositions for banjo and orchestra, and some other rock and roll stuff.
Banjo and orchestra, is that classical style?
Well, my compositions. Set for full orchestra or a string quartet or chamber orchestra.
But it's a symphonic orchestra.
Yes, right. Yeah, not like a hillbilly band
doing,
or something.
No, I mean, you're not doing jazz. You're doing classical.
Well, I'm doing my works,
compositions. Works, which are... How would you classify? Crossover.
I don't know. Crossover. Yeah. There you go.
Okay. So this is what you do. It's wonderful to have you here, Mike. I guess we could talk forever.
We could.
You are a unique performer. And I guess what you're doing is terribly important. We need a voice, a voice that will not necessarily protest as much as just, as we said, state what is going on and state the views of people and not make any assumptions or judgments. And I think that's a very, very nice is a weak word, but it's a refreshing thing to see, coupled, of course, with music.